Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Speaking of Reliability. Now, my name is Chris Jackson, and for frequent listeners, you're usually used to more than one person talking at the same time, but we've recently tried just having some single speaker podcasts which go into more of the history of some of the reliability engineering issues, incidents, lessons learned, and so on. And today, we're going to be looking at an issue that resulted in General Motors having to recall 2.6 million vehicles in 2014 because of a defective ignition switch. Now, this is a great story in terms of what we can learn from it. Not a great story from General Motors' perspective, nor the people driving the vehicles affected, but there is a really good cautionary tale which really points to a phrase I'm a big fan of, and that is earlier changes the economics. Now, what does that mean? Reliability engineering is often seen as a statistical endeavor or a fact-finding mission, or someone who just knows every possible way something can fail, and it's far from it. Reliability engineering, making stuff reliable, involves making the right calls as early as possible, not trying to imagine every single failure scenario, but before you start designing, focusing on the vital few that mattered the most. And with this issue, it unfortunately became associated with deaths and serious injuries, and General Motors, or GM, independently administered compensation programs that ultimately determined 399 claims from drivers were eligible for payment. And GM also had to report they had to pay $554 million to 345 accepted claimants. But that is just the tip of the iceberg, because beyond those numbers there, it incurred hundreds of millions in terms of recall-related costs. It established a victim compensation program. It faced congressional and regulatory scrutiny and agreed to a $900 million federal penalty, and of course, suffered enormous reputational damage. And it's, in a way, it's crazy that something as simple as what we're about to cover, the technology involved is so simple. We know how to do this right, and yet it still causes issues to this relative day. So this is what makes it an extraordinary reliability engineering story. General Motors knew there was a problem with the ignition switch, which is at the heart of this story, before the affected vehicles even went into production. And it gets better, because prototype testing showed the switch didn't meet GM's own torque specification, and nevertheless, it was approved for production. Now, what that meant is that the ignition switch could sometimes, and it's on its own accord, simply go move out of the run position on vehicles that were installed, vehicles in which it was installed. And that meant that if you're driving down a highway in one of these General Motor vehicles with this ignition switch installed, your car could essentially just stop going. You'll stop running while you're traveling at 100 kilometers an hour or 60 miles an hour, or whatever the right metric of velocity is for where you live. And the story gets even better beyond that. Now, within a few years, actually, General Motors considered an improvement that cost less than $1 per vehicle. When I say within a few years, I mean within a few years of development. So before it went into production, there was a solution costing less than $1 per vehicle, and GM chose not to do it. So this episode really isn't about ignition switches. It's about the economics of reliability, because reliability problems don't usually start with they don't start expensive. We make them expensive by allowing them to progress through the product lifecycle. So what is an ignition switch? Now, most listeners are drive vehicles, or at the very least have been a passenger of a vehicle. And so what the switch does is that it allows the vehicle to be in an off, accessory, run, or start mode. So off, everything's turned off. Accessory, the vehicle, the engine's not going, but the key has been turned so that things like the radio and in some vehicles, the air conditioning can be turned on. The run mode or run position is where the engine is running and the ignition allows the key, the ignition switch allows the engine to continue to run. And last but not least, the start mode or start position allows the engine to start in the first place. That's where electricity flows through the starter motor. The starter motor turns around the engine, turns around the crankshaft and the engine until the engine starts, and then the key immediately goes back to the run position. Your key cannot stay in the start position. That's where you have to physically turn the key to the start position. If you remove your hand, it will just pop back to the run position, run mode. And so that allows you to start and then control your car. So the key needs to stay in run. So inside the ignition switch is a mechanical mechanism that creates resistance to rotation. And the driver should have to apply a deliberate amount of torque to move the key away from the run position. Because if you don't have that torque requirement met, then simple bumps and vibration and heavy keychains and accidental contact with the key can provide enough torque to rotate the switch out of the run position to either accessory or off. Again, that's where the engine stops running while you're traveling at Mach 17 down a highway. It's a bad situation to be in. And when the engine gets turned off, everything like power steering gets shut off as well. It's not good. So what was actually wrong? The switch had insufficient torque resistance between run and the accessory or off positions or modes. In other words, it was way too easy to turn. And that was the fundamental defect. Now, under certain circumstances, while someone was driving, the ignition switch could move out of run when it was bumped and creating that disastrous scenario I just explained. And the U.S. Department of Justice summarized this problem as a switch designed and manufactured with too low torque resistance, allowing it to move too easily from run into accessory or off. And so we're not talking about space age technology. We're not talking about some novel design solution to a historical problem. Ignition switches involve a technology that is well known, and a lot of reliability problems, especially with novel machines, are often seen as a necessary bugbear as we move into more technologically advanced products. But it really is amazing that sometimes the more technologically advanced our products become, the easier it is for us to take our eyes off the traditional engineering things. And so that's very, very important to know. So this wasn't some mysterious, unknowable failure mechanism, far from it. GM had a specification for the required torque. Prototype testing found that the switch was below that specification before production, and the engineer responsible approved it for production. Let that sink in. The engineer responsible approved it for production. More than $1 billion mistake. And that's right. This is the key, if you pardon the pun, to the whole story. It's a central concept of what we're about to talk about. And so when we talk about reliability engineering, you cannot talk about the mechanisms, the faults, the defects, the occurrence, the detectability, everything else without talking about the severity of the outcome. So I know I've been sort of intimating at how it is a really bad deal that the key could move out of the run position when your vehicle is going, but let's really sink our teeth into that scenario. So if you have an ignition switch which unintentionally moves out of the run position, the engine can shut down and power assistance to steering and braking can be lost. Now, this doesn't mean you can't steer or brake, but it does make it substantially more difficult. And the vehicle may crash. Now, think about this from a human perspective, especially at high speeds. When you're traveling on a highway, as humans, ration our brain activity. We don't focus on things that are unlikely to present themselves when we're driving down a highway. And so while we do brake on a highway, we are braking more or less to control speed versus come to a stop. While we might be steering left and right, is to change lanes more so than make a 90-degree turn. And so imagine And the other thing too, I should say about highway driving is some people can be doing that for hours in relatively safe, relatively benign conditions. You're still traveling at quite a high speed, but some of the most boring driving you will ever do is when you're driving on a highway across half a continent. So when the engine unexpectedly turns off 3.5 hours into a trip, all of a sudden you realize you're slowing down, the engine's not making any noise, and as your brain's trying to process what is happening, all of a sudden when it comes time to turn that steering wheel or apply brakes or do anything similar, it requires a lot more effort to do those things. It might make you immediately feel like something truly catastrophic has happened to your vehicle while it is little more than the engine has stopped providing power assistance to velocity and your ability to steer and brake. Other really big issue too is that when the engine gets turned off, airbags might not deploy. And so when General Motors was explaining the situation later, if a collision occurred while the switch was in accessory or off, the airbags could simply fail to deploy, which is obviously a really bad deal. So you have a really nasty sequence. The switch moves, engine shuts down, steering braking assistance is affected, accident risk increases, airbag protection may simultaneously be unavailable, which is a lot more serious than a simple car stalling situation. And realistically, with the number of automatic transmissions we have these days, car stalling is something that we are not trained for the way we perhaps once were when we were all familiar with manual or stick shifts. So like I said earlier, the problem was found well before production. According to the Department of Justice, before the defective switch went into production in 2002, GM engineers knew that it was prone to easy movement out of run, and prototype testing showed that the torque return between run and accessory was below GM's internal specification. So it was a specification they were testing for it, not a surprising failure mechanism, yet the switch went into production. So what is the point of having an engineering specification if failing that specification doesn't cause you to do anything? This is a human-centric failure mechanism, or failure mode, I should say. And so even if you have processes, sometimes the fact you have exhausting processes, you have exhaustive testing, it makes you feel like reliability is happening. But if these processes, these tests are giving you information and you're not acting on it, then you have problems. And you really need to ask yourself, what would cause an engineer to approve something that failed a test? What does that say about any pressures he or she was under, the culture at the time, decision-making? I sense you can see where I'm going with that rhetorical question. Now, the problem started to emerge in 2004 and 2005. Now, remember at the start I said in 2014, that's when all the penalties were all the financial penalties that General Motors had to endure started to come into fruition. But again, this story starts before 2002, with 2004 and 5 being the years where this problem started to emerge, where employees, customers, media reps were experiencing unexpected stalls and engine shutoffs. Now, GM considered corrective action, but the problem was treated as something other than a safety defect. NASA has a good track record with this sort of stuff as well. If you have an issue, one of the easiest things to do to minimize the amount of effort you need to implement is to move it from a safety or some sort of fleet grounding category to something much less than that. The severity was essentially downgraded. Now, according to the Department of Justice, engineers decided against fixing the switch, citing costs and other factors. And GM instead provided dealerships with guidance intended to reduce the likelihood of unintended switch movement. Essentially say, hey, drivers, just be careful with this key. And this is where that $1 cost comes into play. GM considered an improvement to the head of the ignition key that was significantly reduced unintended shutoffs for the vehicles that were continuing to be produced with this ignition switch issue. And it was rejected for less than $1. Now, remember that, because we're going to go back over some numbers as well, but less than $1 a vehicle, that was considered too much. Now, the problem then becomes a recall when we fast forward to 2014. GM initially recalled affected vehicles and expanded the ignition switch recall to around about 2.6 million vehicles. Now, for anyone involved in recalls, that's a huge number. Anyone involved in recalls of big products like cars, and not little products like, for example, computer mice or something similar than that, similar to that, you can just imagine the scale of this recall. And the vehicles that, that included the Chevrolet Cobalt, the Chevrolet HHR, Pontiac G5, Solstice, Saturn Ion, and Saturn Sky. So relatively well-known vehicles. But by this stage in 2014, the economics have completely changed. So before production, you could change a component or design, essentially use a different ignition switch mechanism. They had plenty on offer. So had that engineer not approved this defective ignition switch, it would have been a negligible cost. Had they implemented a recall in 2004 and 5, that would have been a much smaller recall. And because they kept producing vehicles with this faulty switch from 2004 onwards, that led to a huge recall, 2.6 million vehicles. And so after they, just to go through what a recall involves, by the way, means that General Motors identifies affected VINs, contacts owners, manufactures replacement components, distributes those parts, schedule dealerships, pay technicians, provide transportation, administer the recall, handle litigation, compensate victims, deal with regulators. And then after they've done that, they then get to go to bed. So that was about $680 million all told just for the recall associated with these 2.6 million vehicles. So a substantial amount of money was spent just on that part. But with those figures and statistics I threw out at the start of this conversation, you know it is a lot more than that, because when we go through GM's filings, what did we find? We found that hundreds of millions that were associated with those recall-related costs were just a small drop in the ocean. Victim compensation. GM created an independently administered compensation program receiving over 4,000 claims. 400 were determined eligible, and it paid, GM had to pay $554 million to 345 eligible claimants who had accepted offers, and of course, not all did. So let's just do some quick math. So you had 345 eligible claimants, I should say, $554 million. You're looking at, what's the math say on that one? Maybe $1.5 to $1.7 million per claimant. That's a lot more than a single dollar per vehicle. But that's where the federal government, the US federal government, then came into play. Because this was a safety issue, and there were issues with how General Motors treated the safety issue once they became aware of it. That's where governments view those sorts of things very dimly, and they essentially received $900 million in terms of fines, or I don't think the correct term was is a fine, but long story short, General Motors had to pay for $900 million to the government. And with the federal case, focusing on GM's failure to disclose this safety defect to the NHTSA, which is a transportation authority in the US, misleading customers about it. So GM's 2014 recall activity went way beyond that single defect, because it recorded about $2.9 billion in charges related to recall campaigns and courtesy transportation overall. So it's not just the ignition switch issue. It actually triggered a broader wave of recalls, which is very common, especially in the United States, very litigious country, where it doesn't take much for a class action to be initiated. And that's where management time, investigation, lawyers, congressional hearings, you name it. It's just an absolute, as we would say in Australia, a dog's breakfast, which is... it's not a very flattering term to describe the situation. So the key lesson here is that the cost of a failure is a function of time. Earlier changes the economics in reliability engineering. So if you find that in this case the switch doesn't meet your torque requirement, the potential responses you have available to you should be change the design or do something And before you, and we're talking about during a prototype selection, the cost would be of using a tried and true ignition switch, switching to that. Yes, it would involve some dollars, no doubt. But in terms of a dollar cost per vehicle, it could be less than 1 cent when it's spread over the number of vehicles. Remember, 2.6 million vehicles were recalled. So let's just do some basic maths. Let's just say you have to spend, I'll make the math easy, $260,000 to find an alternate ignition switch after it fails prototype testing or redevelop a new prototype. Let's just say $260,000. Well, that is 10 cents per vehicle if we go off $2.6 million later on. So a really small number. But again, many organizations can really nickel and dime engineers to the point where they might be afraid to even suggest changes which involve a small cost. And the argument that the accountants will often say, well, if you have a million tiny costs, you have one big cost. I get it. But here we are. If it fails your specification, you really shouldn't allow it to be approved if you think it's going to cost something. So it really is a function of time. So concept design, perhaps the cost could have been negligible, less than 10 cents a vehicle, because other vehicles didn't have that ignition switch. Once you've done the prototype, it's still, you have lots of options once the thing fails. Now, once you start production tooling and supply chain, now the costs to change it are a lot higher once the vehicles have been manufactured. Again, inventory, factories, vehicles leaving dealerships are way more expensive. But when you leave it to the point in time where millions of vehicles are with customers, and then even worse, people have been injured, it is a devastating financial blow. So this is what reliability engineering is actually for. This is where I bring it back directly back to our philosophy. Earlier changes the economics. And so one of the enduring problems I personally have with the reliability engineering industry, as it's seen by those external to it, some of those external to it and some of those internal to it, reliability engineering is often presented as, let's just test the product and see whether it's reliable. That's it. That's all about observing a problem or admiring a problem. But once you get to the point of testing something, a ton of effort and energy, in some cases money, has been spent. And let's not forget the personal attachment an engineer might have to that prototype. So a much better philosophy is to find ways the product can fail while those failures are still cheap to eliminate. And that's where things like Vermeers and other tools can be implemented when done properly before your first design. Some people might be rolling their eyes when I say, hey, Vermeer is a great tool. There are Vermeers, they're like personal trainers. They can be really good for you, they can be really bad for you. There's a lot of products out there, or a lot of services, a lot of things out there where the good ones are really good and the bad ones are really bad. And 9 times out of 10 these days, it feels like a Vermeer is seen as a very bad activity. That's usually because it's done without any sense of the intent of a Vermeer, which is to improve design. I feel like a lot of these days, Vermeers are ordeals that are forced upon us for us to be able to claim that we have complied with some sort of standard, but that's a whole new podcast. So again, going back to the main point, Vermeers are a great way of being able to get on top of this because then there's lots of other things too. I mean, GM was in a way doing things right. They had a prototype, they tested it, they had a specification, they knew what failure looked like. So they were looking for ways this new prototype could not meet the requirement or specification, and they found it and they ignored it anyway. So GM actually did find this problem early. So in a way, their processes worked. We need to ask ourselves, why didn't it then trigger action, or why did it not influence the right decision? So the reliability failure wasn't simply we failed to identify the failure mode. It was we failed to turn reliability information into an engineering decision. Now, one of my colleagues back in the Australian Army often said, I don't think he came up with the quote or phrase. If you've been in the military, you often find that some really good phrases or quotes or anecdotes sort of do the rounds. But a lesson learned, the quote is, I've really done a bad job of setting it up. But he would often tell me that a lesson learned that doesn't involve learning is actually an observation. And I think that's a really important message too. You can't just have a lessons learned database. If it doesn't change anything, then your database simply turns into an observation. And so the whole idea of reliability engineering is to encourage critical thinking, empower critical thinking. And yes, if something fails, I test and do something about it. So think about the journey this failure took. Before production, prototype ignition, switch failed, GM zone torque specification. A few years later, customers were reporting vehicles unexpectedly switching off. That was when a lot fewer than 2.6 million vehicles were affected. GM then had a choice to consider an improvement costing less than $1 per vehicle it was currently manufacturing. And they said no. They would have probably, because that would have also then forced them to initiate a recall for the much smaller fleet of vehicles that had been sold. So the problem was eliminated. The vehicles affected then swelled to 2.6 million. More deaths and deaths and injuries were incurred as a result. Hundreds of millions more went into a victim compensation and, of course, a $900 million penalty. And like I said, perhaps the most important thing is that people were killed and seriously injured as a result of this crazy decision-making process. And that's why good reliability engineering isn't about testing or admiring problems. It is about trying to find failures before they cost you lots of money to resolve. Earlier changes the economics. So finding things early and acting early is what reliability engineering is. Yes, I teach viable analysis courses and all the other stuff, so statistical stuff like that, and do reliability allocation. But at its heart, you are doomed to an unreliable product if you don't look for potential failures early. There's no point testing an unreliable product. That's, again, admiring a problem. Reliability engineering is first and foremost designing reliable stuff. And then there might be a role for statistics thereafter. So hopefully that gives you guys some sort of insight into that particular incident. Hopefully you enjoyed this little history lesson. And I think it's very important to keep reminding ourselves as reliability engineers that this stuff still happens to this day. And that ignition switch is a really simple mechanical device that should not be causing problems in this day and age. But if you take your eye off the ball, if you are creating, for example, vehicles which are self-driving this or electronic that, or have those cool cameras which show you a virtual 3D image of your car, but then you forget to make an ignition switch that works properly, it's all for naught. So if you like this podcast, please let us know. If you want to leave feedback, of course, you've got my contact details. If you found this podcast, you're able to reach out to Ascendo Reliability. But the main tool for communication we advertise is a page on the website, www.ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there you can leave a voice message if you want, if you are too lazy to type something on the keyboard. And we do take your feedback very seriously. A lot of podcasts come from your suggestions. But yeah, let us know how this little history lesson went, and if you enjoyed this one person show. And if you did, we might keep doing it. All right, beyond that, have a splendid day.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.